myself and Dave have, you know, had kids, obviously not together. But, you know, we've had, you know, we've had people, loved ones die on us, and, you know, and all kinds of life and death have happened with us over the years. And there were times when you think, how the God's name am I going to go into there and be happy?
Welcome to the Social Fabric Podcast with me, Andreas Blendori. And this week, my guest is Dermot Whelan. This episode was recorded at the Whale Theatre on the 16th of November 2023 and is called Will the Real Dermot Whelan Please Stand Up? This is part one of two. Please subscribe, share and review. It's the only way podcasts like this have a chance to survive. For more information and more episodes, please visit socialfabric.ie. The title tune is Happy and Shiny by The Roundabouters.
Please ensure that your mobile phone is set to silent. And thank you for choosing the Whale Theatre. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, 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 hello. Good evening, good evening, hello. Good evening, welcome. And welcome to the Whale Theatre and to the Social Fabric Podcast Live. I will be your host, Andreas Blendori. And I know you came here to listen to me talking for the next 2 hours, so I really appreciate it. And I'm going to tell you my life story. But I thought I'll get somebody else to share the stage with me. And it's a guy that I met maybe 12 months ago with some mutual friends. The first thing that struck me about him was really his generosity and his warmth. And I thought, this is a lovely guy. I'd love to know more about him. You know, I'd love to spend a couple hours having a chat with him. So I thought, why don't we get two chairs, two microphones, and an audience, and have a chat. So will you please welcome Mr. Dermot Whelan. I didn't get half of that. Please sit down, Dermot. Thanks for coming. Thanks.
How are you?
Great. Thank you for coming. So Dermot came. It took him about 6 hours to get here. Thanks a million.
You know, I think it's only in Ireland where I came over from Howth and I got three trains. And I didn't change station or platform. I mean, that is just the same track, but it took me three trains. But we got here eventually, and it's so beautiful to be here. You can smell the money. I mean, see. You can smell the sea. That's what I meant to say.
I was really worried when you say I'm on the train. I thought, that's called the dart. Where is he going? But thanks for coming here. And we'll talk about how you practice mindfulness on the train later on. But
yes, it was a good test. Irish Rail are there to teach us lessons and help us to get in touch with our calmer inner selves.
So, Dermot, I texted Dermot a couple of days ago and I said, Dermot, are you still on for the show? Thinking, Jesus.
I sent back, who dis?
And he came back and said, yeah, of course. I said, okay, thank God for that. And then he said, you said something interesting. He said, I'm really looking forward to it. And I thought, so the question is, what are you looking forward to?
I'm really worried now. I'm always up for a chat, and, you know, we've had snippets, we've had little conversations along the way, and the opportunity to sit with you. I know, you know, the Social Fabric is such a, it's such a well-named podcast because, you know, you're very interested, very involved, and very passionate about people and the connections that they make, most importantly, you know. And to be out here in Greystone, simply, I've never been to this theatre before. Isn't it just magic? And I love, I was only saying to Andrea before we came out here so dramatically from behind the curtain, that, you know, to be able to put on these events where it isn't jazz hands, you know, that people are coming to these kinds of nights because they want to hear ideas. They want to hear philosophies. They want to hear new perspectives, you know. And I think we're so lucky at the moment. You know, I don't know where it, I guess in a way it might have come out of the whole podcast movement, in that people, you know, are willing to, and certainly I am, I'm the same when I'm sitting in an audience. I want to hear new perspectives and ideas and things that make me go, I never thought of it that way, you know, and it doesn't have to be a big, you know, song and dance. Although Andrea will be doing a saxophone solo in 20 minutes.
The problem for you is you have to give us all that wisdom, because I'm only gonna ask you a couple of questions. So be ready for being really interesting. I told everybody you're really...
Okay.
I said he's really interesting.
I'll be as wise as I can be.
So I genuinely don't know anything about Dermot. We've some mutual friends and we met a couple of times. We had a lovely lunch and we had a lovely walk. And I say that you probably heard that I really thought your generosity. I actually wore Dermot's golf shoes for a walk, which was the first time I wore golf shoes, and we went climbing a mountain. So it was fantastic.
Yeah. So what's that really was weird is that we have the same size feet. I can't help but feel shortchanged in this whole. You're like, yeah. Really, God? The feet?
Yes.
I think it just started there and got bored. Next. You tired him out.
That's it. But so I know nothing about Dermot, and we just had a quick chat upstairs for the last 3 minutes, because that's how long we had together before the show. So let's get to know you a little bit, if you don't mind. And, you know, I know you come from somewhere outside Limerick, a place that nobody knows. You can tell us the name of the place if you like, but nobody knows it anyway. But tell us, what's your earliest memory of that place that nobody knows?
Oh, well, the place that nobody knows is called Ballyclock
in
County Limerick.
No, you're lying. You're absolutely lying. Nobody knows it. Go on.
Don't be whooping and hollering like you're from there.
There's no
way.
Is
there anyone from Limerick here?
No.
No.
Of course not.
No, we got one.
No.
Boy, the kid.
Oh, that's low. Yeah. Well done, Laura. Okay, so seriously.
Great. I do the handbags, you do the wallets, all right? They're loaded out here, kid. I grew up in County Limerick. Yes, Ballyclock is about 5 miles from Limerick City. And I guess it was a place of, you know, tractors pulling hay and all that kind of stuff. The next town up the road was called Mianus. And life before PlayStation meant that for entertainment, we would get a bottle of Tippex and, you've guessed it, go down to the crossroads and take out the ME and change the sign to anus, and good times.
And that's your earliest memory?
My best memory. I guess, it was a nice childhood. I'm the youngest of 6 siblings, good Catholic family. And my dad worked in a factory in Limerick that made artificial hips and knees and elbows and those kinds of things. It was legit, like it was. I was just doing it out of the back of a van or anything. it was a nice upbringing. You know, we played in hay barns and we went on little adventures and camping and played hurling. What am I talking about? I never played hurling. I played football up in the local club, which was South Liberties GA, where a few famous Limerick hurlers come from. And went to the local national school up the road, which was one of those old, like, anytime I show my kids, they're like, what age are you? Like, are you in black and white? Because, you know, those old schoolhouses, you know, like, there was a standard schoolhouse and it had the plaque like established 1902 or whatever. And then the classic, you know, encirclement of prefabs. It was a nice upbringing. Went to a Jesuit secondary school in Limerick, Crescent College. And I guess growing up beside the Limerick Golf Club, as there, if there's any golfers here, you might know Limerick Golf Club, but We used to spend our time looking for golf balls that golfers had lost and then selling them same balls back to the same golfers.
So it sounds like an idyllic childhood.
I guess it wasn't quite like Enid Blyton, but it was. I was very lucky, I have to say. Yeah, a lot of freedom. That kind of freedom is not being dished out to our own kids. We're so selfish with it, isn't it? Like, we all had amazing childhoods. Oh, go away at 9 o'clock in the morning, come back at 9 o'clock in the evening. And now, even though we know that was great, we won't let our kids do it at all, you know? It's like, where are you? Text me when you're at the gate. You're like, still at the front door.
Are you that kind of father?
I'm pretty chill, I think, much to my wife's annoyance a lot of the time, where I'm going, it'll be grand, it'll be fine. But I try, you know, I guess I try, like many of us here who have, people have children here, any, yeah?
Yes, we do.
We're all too exhausted to even raise our hands.
But that's interesting. You're talking about, you know, leaving the house at 9 o'clock in the morning and going change, you know, the signs with TPEX and whatever, all that wonderful stuff you did. Now, how do you deal with your kids? They go off at 9 o'clock in the morning. Do you let them go for the day?
I think it's weird. I used to get kind of perplexed that my kids wouldn't just go out. Like, they're not inclined to sort of head out. And I guess that's what we've shaped them into, you know. COVID was very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of you might have found that once the perpetual parental taxi and playdate frenzy ground to a halt because of our friend the virus, suddenly all the kids in the neighborhood were out on the road, and you're like, I didn't even know there were this many children here. But they were all playing and, you know, doing the thing, building camps and making go-karts, and how quickly they went into that, you know. And it's not, you think that, oh God, they're totally past it. It's just sometimes we do push back a little bit against the constant play dating and organized free time. Yeah. And I think sometimes we fail to put our kids ourselves into our children's schedules and go, how would I, even as an adult, feel about the schedule that they have? Mm-hmm. You know, if you were going to work, you're getting up in the morning, they have your whole school day, you know, and if you were doing that a whole day at work, and then, you know, Tuesday you had drama after work, you know, Wednesday you had dancing, you know, then you had football, you had GA and soccer, you'd be like, this is an unsustainable schedule. You know, but our kids are like, come on, you know. And then you throw in homework on top of it. It's like the constant hours of homework is like doing a master's, you know, or something. So we schedule them to death. And then we go, why are they all so anxious and stressed out?
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
So, you know, it's hard, though. It's hard because you want them to... You're terrified of them someday turning around going, you never brought me to dancing and I could have been a star, you know. But I do try and put myself in their shoes, and you know, they've got hectic schedules, and I think trying to encourage them, just like we should encourage ourselves, you know, to create that space, you know. Yeah. If no space in our week or in our day, we tend to have quite a little amount of space, you know, in our minds and in between events or in between, you know, things happening where we either react or respond. And I think if we create the space in other places, we'll find that we have space in how we react to the events of the day.
Okay, before you go into your mindfulness stuff, let me bring you back to your. Yeah, I know. They all bought a book already. They're already there to sell, and they have tickets for your shows. Don't worry. But but you were saying something really interesting upstairs, because I'm always fascinated about the upbringing. But you just discovered something. You went on a search of your grandfather. Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, it turns out he's dead. I mean,
it was a short search.
Yeah.
was his name?
His name was Paddy Whelan, or Captain Patrick Whelan. So he was a captain in the old IRA, which is, that little prefix is very important. So he was born in Wexford, moved to Cove as a child, and then ended up in Middleton. So that whole kind of, that part of Cork was very, very active for what was known as the Flying Columns, those moving battalions under British rule during the War of War of Independence. And I guess it was a part of my family history that I really, you know, you kind of have a vague sense of grandparents and, you know, great uncles and these things, but you don't quite know. And it was actually my cousin who lives in Los Angeles who got in touch and said, have you read this? And she sent me a document. And it was a military document. And a lot of them have been digitized in recent years. So instead of being locked away, which would they, you know, there are the hard copies in archives, but you can go on and just download these accounts. And in the 50s, and I think it was part of a prerequisite for qualifying for a particular pension, you had to, if you fought for Ireland, you had to document your memories. And so he documented his entire experience of the War of Independence. And the detail is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And that kind of sent us down a rabbit hole of looking at other, you know, his comrades' accounts. And it's, I think it's, weirdly, it's a time in our history, the War of Independence. It was kind of glossed over in school. And I think there was, particularly possibly because of the Civil War, that was kind of an embarrassing time in our history. And there was a lot of people and in families who may have done very courageous things in the War of Independence, but because the Civil War was such a difficult experience and memory, where brothers were fighting brothers and neighbors fighting neighbors, and who would have been shoulder to shoulder, you know, months before, and now here they were, you know, against each other and you know, doing terrible things to each other. I think as a result of that, it was sort of shunned. But when you dip back into these military archives, and I guess for me, because I have a personal connection, I guess there's probably a load of people in this room who would have similar connections. It's just a fascinating thing to kind of go and walk the streets and see the house where my grandfather grew up. And, you know, his dad was worked for the, I think they were called the lightships, and they basically went around and repaired lighthouses and things. But, you know, Cove is extra poignant as well, because that's where everybody got onto the Titanic. It was the final stop before it hit the voyage, you know, took off, went Belfast, Southampton, Cove, and then, you know, obviously never quite made the whole way. So it's quite an impressive town and an interesting, I guess, you know, it represents a lot of Irish history, you know, that little town. And it's a place that I knew absolutely nothing about. So to be delving in there, I think when we go back and we try and understand what our ancestors and relatives did, you know, and the decisions they made and why they made them, I think we get a little bit of sense of who we are as well, you know.
And what's that done to you so far? Like discovering all these things, has anything changed?
You start to understand family a bit better, you know, because I remember my dad always talked about my grandfather as being a difficult man, you know, and my mother would have said that as well, you know, and he was harsh and strict and lost his temper, and then when you read his account of what he did in his 20s, you know, these were all really young men. A lot of them were just kids. You know, if you've got late teenagers kind of leaving cert age or even sort of transition year, these guys were putting on uniforms and you know, shooting people, you know, ambushing black and tans, and they were getting killed and injured. And so, you know, when you in your family, you might hear of, oh, this grandfather was a very difficult man and always very angry. And then you think, classic PTSD, you know, and there was no mention of PTSD or understanding, you know, it was kind of shell shock maybe was the closest for people coming back from the war. But you know, how were they meant to process those things that they witnessed, you know, over a number of years? And then to go from that into a quiet family life, that adjustment, you know, for the military people a lot of the time is really impossible, because their adrenals are on a whole other level to normal people, and a lot of them just can't find peace in that supposedly peaceful environment, you know.
So I just want to move it on a little bit, because I know then probably that's your wanting to learn things. It brought you to follow one of the greatest archaeologists ever lived, Indiana Jones, right?
Yes.
So tell us about that. How did that work out for you?
Great. I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark when I was 11 and thought it was the greatest thing I had ever witnessed, and decided there and then that I would be an archaeologist. And years later, I went to Trinity and studied archaeology and French. sure where that came in. But, you know, going on my first digs, I quickly realized many things. Raiders of the Lost Ark is absolutely nothing like real archaeology. Like, nothing. And in particular, Harrison, like, Indiana Jones is the worst archaeologist. Like, absolutely terrible, should be sacked, you know. Has no respect for any of the communities or the... Like, every single building he goes into collapses 20 minutes later. He steals antiquities, takes records of nothing, you know.
Sorry for bringing it up, Dermot.
Yeah.
It's obviously still hurt.
It was quite difficult to deal with, you know, and particularly Irish archaeology, you know, where you're basically, you know, sitting in the location of a new petrol station that's about to be built, so somewhere off a motorway, you know, in a ditch in the rain, you know. There's nobody shouting, "Dr. Jones, Dr. Jones! Your father is trapped in the belly of that steel beast." No.
So that didn't work out the way you were hoping.
No, it was fun, and I made a lot of wonderful friends. But the archaeology, I think I left it there.
But from that type of work you were open to get into, that leap of faith into stand-up comedy, I can't really see it.
No, neither can I.
Because that's the chronology, right? Am I getting it right?
Well, when I left college, I ended up just filling in for a friend who was sick in the production office of a film. And then I ended up doing that for 6 years.
Oh, okay.
I became an AD, or an assistant director.
Okay.
Basically, I made a lot of tea and a lot of coffee for a lot of actors.
Okay.
But spent a huge amount of time in Wicklow. Actually, most of my 20s was coming down to Wicklow in various parts, Lugalaw, and I worked on a show called Ballycus Angel, mm-hmm. which I think was a... I don't know.
He's my next guest.
I thought that was a fond groan or a... it was, I guess it was a precursor to Room to Improve, in terms of if you had the fear on a Sunday, it was this nice, calm, "Oh, look, oh, your one is riding the priest. Oh, lovely." Good, wholesome family viewing. But it was shot, a lot of it was shot down in Avoca, in County Wicklow. So I spent an awful lot of time down there. With all the wonderful locals who would wait on the bridge every morning because they wanted to be extras, because you got paid £56 a day, if you know, and you might just be used for 10 minutes and you still get paid. So they'd all be there going, "Dermot, can I be an extra in the film?" Which, they were wonderful, but there was only so many of them, and we filmed for a long time, so we had to keep coming up with interesting ways of making them all look different, you know. You know, wait a minute, that nurse, wasn't she a guard 20 minutes ago?
Wonderful.
Giving people limps just to make them look a little bit different.
So anyway, 6 years in Wicklow, and you got the accent, and it's great.
But
Dermot, there's a gal. There's a Dars tournament on tonight in Nagels, Dermot. Are you coming over?
but comedy. Where'd you get?
I left film and I went to work in radio, and I could do quite a good impression of a newsreader. So I did a demo tape and I sent it into 98FM, and they gave me a job reading the news at the weekend. And I knew nothing about current affairs, like nothing, embarrassing. And I remember I used to ask the sports guy, like, what's he the minister for? And they're like, he's in the opposition. I'd be like, the opposition? What's that? But I've always had this weird combination of wanting to push myself into situations where I'm extremely uncomfortable, but like being super anxious at the same time. So it was, I was compared to like having one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake, and you're like, why am I doing this to myself? So I ended up just doing news with a very kind of, at 6 o'clock, here's the headlines. And I used to do that, and then I got a job. I used to use the news studio to make comedy sketches after work, and use the kind of the news software, you know, and make up fake news reports and all that, like Not the 9 o'clock News and all that. I loved those shows, like Brass Eye, and then I got a job doing comedy for the breakfast show at the time, and
on 98FM.
On 98FM, yeah. And then after a while, then they got sacked. And then they gave me the job. And that's how I kind of started off in radio.
You were in radio for a while.
21 years, yeah. So I started doing it, kind of being an overnight jock. And then myself and Dave got literally put together in some kind of weird play date.
Did you hear that? So
he's still alive. We're still friends. For anyone who doesn't know, I presented with Dave, my mate, on 98FM and Today FM for the last 20 years. So and I just left in August.
So that's Dave Morton. My first question is Dermot and Dave. Who decides? Because I mean, if you go alphabetically, it's Dave and Dermot. So is that because you're better?
I like to think so. Well spotted. It's a radio thing. You have the shorter syllable at the end. It's just the thing.
Oh,
as
yeah,
I explained
yeah.
to Dave.
Like, he's not well. I invited him. He didn't want to come.
Yeah. But like, they do crazy things. Like one time, like how Dave put up with it over the years. One day he came into work and we were about kind of four years into our Dermot and Dave stint. And he was just putting the stuff in the log, as it's called, you know, just putting, lining up the ads and the songs and all that. And then he saw, oh, there's new jingles. So he tested it and it went, Ruth and Dermot on 98FM. And I was like, wait a minute, why is my name second? And he was like, why is my name gone? So the bosses had decided they were going to put a girl in with us and never told us. And then Dave was like, well, why are you? And it's like, you know, it's always these Australian consultants, you know, who are brought in. And
why Australians?
Who just go around with this briefcase of nonsense, you know, are these things. It worked in Sydney. And you're like, and like, listen, just a guy and a girl is just a better way. And I think the audience can relate. And we need to female relatability. And it's just getting too blokey. But Dave was like, but who do people think I am? Like this disembodied voice coming from, like, and they're like, they'll just, you know, this is okay, don't worry about it. They'll get used to it. And it's like, this is weird. But those kinds of things happened all the time, you know.
But that's a long time. And I know you, I don't know Dave, but on the radio you come across like a great partnership. And but it must have been hard as well to be that upbeat all the time. Like you entertained the nation for whatever time. Was it 10 to 12? I can't remember what it was.
On Today FM was 9 to 12.
9 to 12. So
the classic Alan Partridge shift. Aha! It's Dermot and Dave.
But, you know, any jobs, getting up every morning and being happy is kind of hard, right?
Yeah, it's reminiscent of that scene in The Simpsons when they go to Itchy and Scratchy Land and it's New Year's Eve every 10 minutes. And, one of the workers just grabs Marge Simpson by the arm and goes, kill me now. 5, 4. So I guess there's an element of that. Yeah, I mean, yes, it is quite draining, you know. It's not that you're sort of someone else when you're doing it, but you're definitely a heightened version of yourself, you know, and you can't really, you know, the days when you're like, you know, at the coffee machine, you know, and somebody's like, how are you getting on? You're like, ugh, you can't be that, you know. It can't go like, Dermot and Dave on Today FM. I don't know, just talk amongst yourselves or... I'm just a bit meh. But, you know, on the flip side, you know, myself and Dave have, you know, had kids, obviously not together. But, you know, we've had people, loved ones die on us and, you know, and all kinds of life and death have happened with us over the years. And there were times when you think, how in God's name am I going to go into there and be happy? But actually, we used to find that when you went in there and you had stuff going on outside, that it was like a sanctuary. You know, you go, look, at least for the next 3 hours, I am literally going to be forced into the present moment because, you know, it's impossible to be morose and thinking about things that are going on. So, you know, in many ways, a lot of the time it was, as I said, a little sanctuary that you thought, you know, I can escape from the things that are going on and I can do it with my best friend, you know.
So I meant to say we always do a little break in a few minutes so you can have another drink. But before the break, I want to ask you, because we'll talk about that after the break, but when you made the decision, and we'll talk about why you made that decision, but Dave as part of that decision, how hard was that?
Making the decision? Or
well, making the decision to leave the show, and you know, obviously you have your own reason to make that decision, but taking into account somebody you spent 21 years with.
Well, it's like walking out of a marriage, you know, and like not in a good way.
He did say they're still friends. I think we're recording this show. I'll ring Dave tomorrow.
No, it was. It was literally like breaking up with somebody. And you're using phrases like, it's not you, it's me, you know, And I guess that's why we stay in these things a little bit longer because, you know, you've such a genuine friendship and not just with him, but with the whole team. You know, I've worked with Maria, our producer, for 18 years, you know. Right. So I think that's what makes it really hard. But I think anybody here who's ever come to a big decision in their lives, whether it's their job or a relationship or anything like that, it starts to become... there's a little bit of what our pal Fiona has called cognitive dissonance. It's one of the phrases I learned from her when she came on the show so many times, where there's a little argument, starts off as a little sort of interesting discussion, and then it gets a little more heated, and then it turns into an argument. And for me, I guess it was kind of an ongoing argument between my head and my gut. You know, my gut was telling me I'm ready for a change now, and your head is going, what are you doing? This is madness. You know, this is a great setup you have. And blah, blah, blah. You know, and sometimes that voice in our head can, I guess, it's almost like echoes of teachers or parents or our authority figures in your life, you know, and it can be quite a loud voice, you know, when you're on the verge of making a big decision that on paper seems mad, you know. But, you know, your gut doesn't really care about those things. It goes, you know, I know what you're ready for now and you need to move on. So, but yeah, it was very, very difficult. But you know what? Like, you know, a best friend, a true friend is going to go, you know, I'm gutted, but I get it, you know. And he then said, well, look, on the upside, for the first time in my life, I'm not going to be And Dave.
Brilliant. So it's Ruth and Dave, is it?
What?
The Ruth, Ruth and Dave.
Yeah. No.
So we might leave it at the cognitive dissonance as a kind of hanging there. We'll come back in a few minutes and we'll have a drink, any type of drink. You all drinking, so. And then we'll come back and I'm going to ask you all about your new life, where we get in, because everybody here wants to know about meditation. So
okay,
be ready for that.
And then we can all get naked.
I'll see you in 50. See you in 50 minutes.
Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dermot Whelan, recorded live in the Whale Theatre in Greystones. Please join me for part 2. Thank you.
Shining like the sun. We left some dreams.